Welcome to Alchemist X Innovators Inside, the podcast where we explore the world of corporate innovation and dive deep into the minds of thought leaders, high achievers, and risk takers. I'm your host, Ian Bergman, and together we'll uncover the challenges, triumphs, and secrets behind successful innovation journeys. Whether you're an aspiring entrepreneur, an industry veteran, or simply curious about the ever-evolving landscape of innovative ideas and what it takes to put them into practice, this is the podcast for you. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and let's embark on this exciting journey together. Logan, welcome to the pod.
Hey, Ian, great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So how are you doing today?
I am doing great. I've got a cup of coffee right here. It is good weather out, and it's just a good day to be running this startup. How about you?
Well, I'm getting rained on in the Pacific Northwest, but I work from home, so I'm in my basement, and I've got the coffee as well. So that's wonderful. Well, thanks for joining us. It's really exciting to have you here. And I always like to start. It's one of those things that just sounds a little pedantic or trivial, but like, we need to start with your story. So your name's Logan. You are co-founder and CEO at Forecaster. What does that mean? Tell me about what you do.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a good jumping off point. So I'll maybe start with what Forecaster is. Whenever you think about Forecaster, essentially what we are is we are a replacement to Excel when it comes to building and managing financial models. And we have a specific focus on startups and SMBs. And to try to ground the value of what we do into reality, I like to paint the picture of larger, more advanced organizations, more mature companies. If you look at most middle market companies and you look at the organizational structures of those companies, you're going to find a lot of the similar departments that you'll see in most startups, like sales, marketing, accounting, things like that. But then you're going to find this other piece of the organization that's called FP&A, and that stands for financial planning and analysis. Mm-hmm. Now, the entire purpose of that department is to analyze data, to look at this data, forecast it into the future, and make informed decisions today based off of what you think could happen in the future. And if you're a much larger, more established company, you have teams of people that can help you make these decisions. But if you're a startup, a smaller company, you don't have the budget to go and hire a CFO or a team of analysts to do this. And that's really why we exist, is we want to take the benefit that FP&A brings to larger organizations, bring them all the way down to startups, to where even if you're a startup that hasn't raised any money, you're on a shoestring budget, you can get a lot of the immense benefits that FP&A has to offer. So that's really why we exist. That's what inspires us. And that's our mission, is to bring FP&A basically to the masses.
I love that. And it's funny, it reminded me of this joke. I think it's a Seinfeld joke, don't hold me to it though, about bobsledding versus the luge, where, you know, it's like luging is like the bobsled, but without the sled, you're just Bob. And when you're a founder, especially an early stage founder, you're alone. You don't have the tools, the resources, the teams. So you need something to help you with this financial modeling. So that's where you guys step in. And it sounds like you get involved right at the beginning.
That's exactly right. Yeah, we're usually, and it's kind of funny because the first time that a founder typically enters into any sort of a realm in finance is through a financial model. And a lot of people don't think about that. A lot of people think that the first time a founder gets into the finance world is with accounting, whenever they go into QuickBooks or anything like that. But that's not usually true. Usually a founder wants to fundraise for their company. They've got an idea. They want to bring that idea into the world. So they go and they start pitching investors. And as a part of that process, you need a pitch deck, you need a data room, but then you need a financial model too. And usually they'll do that before they even get accounting set up. So we like to get in at the very, very ground floor with most companies. We like to earn our stripes, prove our value, and then we like to grow with those companies. It's really a part of our model, is because we work with startups, the unfortunate reality is that a lot of startups end up failing. And by the stats, most startups end up failing. But a lot of startups end up becoming successful, and they continue to grow, and they continue to raise money, and so on and so forth. So that's really our game, is we like to get in at the ground floor. We like to help companies become successful, and we try to share in that success by matching companies where they are and offering services to them that meet them whenever they hit $1 million in revenue, $2 million, $10 million, and so on and so forth. So that's really our core model.
That's awesome. And so, you know, look, I love the world
today for entrepreneurs? Because there's so many incredible tools, right, like Forecaster, that help make everything from your back office to your dev stack just that much easier. Let me ask you a question, though. You know, so many times when I talk to founders, they're focused on, all right, like concept validation, product validation, the proving problem solution fit. They're focused on research. They're focused on figuring out, you know, does anybody care about the thing that I want to solve in the world? When do they start thinking about the need for a financial model? Is there an outside trigger?
Yeah, there will. So the outside trigger is fundraising. That's like our hook whenever it comes to acquiring customers is typically the story goes, I need to pitch an investor, or worst case, an investor asked me for a financial model and I, deer in the headlights, didn't know what they were talking about. So I rushed to go find out whatever I needed to do. And usually they end up at our doorstep. So that's usually the hook point. But whenever I think about when founders should start thinking about financial modeling, it's actually a little bit before they start to fundraise. And I'll kind of share a story to hopefully illustrate some of this. So whenever Forecaster was in its infancy, whenever Forecaster was still an idea that Steven, my co-founder, and I had, we were trying to formulate how we were going to charge for it. And we didn't know, should we go the premium route? Should we just charge $50 a month, $100 a month? Or should we do a freemium, or like, what should that look like? So our original goal, because it was kind of a wide open space, there really wasn't any softwares out there that were trying to tackle this problem. We thought, let's go freemium, right? That makes sense. Let's just get as many customers as we can. Let's monetize them and let's grow. And we, because we're finance people, we immediately went to the spreadsheets at that time and built out a financial model. And we quickly, I mean, this was like first week of the idea, realized that a freemium model wasn't going to work, right? Because whenever you actually model it out, whenever you assume maybe 5-10% of the people that use you actually pay for you, the number of startups that you would need to have using a product like this, it would be like in the tens of millions for us to achieve our goals. So before we did anything, before we tried to sell it anything, we immediately pivoted in our minds and we were like, okay, check that box off. This is not going to be a freemium product. We're going to have to go do something else. And the reason that I share that and why that's important is most founders would have to find that out on the battlefield, right? Like whenever they're actually out selling, they would find that out way down the line versus whenever you do a process of building a financial model, you can uncover things way before you actually start to act on them. And that to me is one of the biggest values of a financial model. It's a simulation of your business once you build it. And then you can kind of play things out that you're just theorizing today into, okay, what does this look like 3 years, 5 years down the line? And is this even possible? And a lot of times, you know, one of the biggest pieces of value that we can add to clients, and we do this all the time, is we'll model something out and we'll come to the conclusion, if you're really early, hey, for you to hit your goals, you're going to need to get 70% market penetration based off of the number of customers, that potential customers that are out there. So immediately that signals in the mind of the founder, hey, maybe this isn't the route to take. This seems like a very difficult path. And then you can kind of shift and change based off of that insight. So long-winded answer by saying the hook point is typically fundraising, but we recommend that you actually start this process earlier than that to try to get some gains from it.
Well, and it makes total sense. And I love that answer. And it was funny because you also hit all of the beats of a really experienced founder pitching and telling their story, right? You had the problem and the pain point and the future vision and the solution. And it makes a lot of sense. What is the reception when you start having conversations with founders? Do they get it? Or do you have to kind of navigate them through a bit of a learning journey?
Yeah, there's definitely a navigation aspect of it. I mean, and this is something that we're constantly battling at Forecaster. And really, I would say a lot of these relatively newer softwares that are out there are facing the same problem, which is like a cultural shift, a cultural mindset shift around financial modeling, specifically for startups. So you've probably heard this, you know, Ian, working with a lot of startups, I certainly hear it all the time, which is this mindset of forecasting is just a waste of time. Building a financial model for any kind of a startup is a complete waste of time because we don't have data. Who can predict the future? I don't know what's going to happen in the next week, let alone the next 5 years.
We're going to pivot 7 times.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're constantly having to battle this negative mindset around financial modeling. Investors say that every now and then as well, of, you know, how can I trust what is in these 5-year projections? And the truthful answer is you really can't, right? If you are super early, the revenue that you're predicting in years 3, 4, and 5 are more or less meaningless, but that doesn't matter because that's not why you're doing this. That's not the purpose of the exercise. The purpose of the exercise is to make sure that you have a nuanced understanding of your revenue formula. If you'd understand how many customers you actually need to acquire on a month-to-month basis in order for you to hit your goals, for you to understand how much cash you need to raise, what are your short-term goals, your medium-term? It's a goal-setting tool. And you know, one of the things that I always say is it's like creating a roadmap for your success. So if you want to sell, for example, your company for $100 million, let's say that's your goal. And let's say you time-bound that goal. You say, I want to sell this company for $100 million in 5 years. I can, using financial modeling, give you a detailed monthly roadmap of everything you need to do in order to hit those goals, you know, and get it to the infinite level of detail. So it's back solving to success more than it is trying to guess what's going to happen next, which is what most people think forecasting is about. It's not. It's a goal-setting framework. It is a manifestation of your own destiny. So there's a bit of a friction point typically when people get started. So you have to go through that spiel of, we're not using this to try to guess what's going to happen next because we already covered that. We don't know what's going to happen next. But what we can do is set goals for ourselves, set goals for our employees, set goals for our investors, and manage to those goals. And that is what a financial model is all about, especially in the early days, whenever you're still trying to figure things out.
Well, I think that's a really important insight for a lot of people, right? This is a tool and a framework to help you understand your goals, your business, et cetera. And it's really interesting. Like, this is actually a really timely conversation we're happening. We're sitting here in early April. And I don't know about you, but I do occasionally get sucked into the cesspool that is the social media site formerly known as Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
And my feed has something of a debate on this topic recently. I don't know if you've seen this, but I think half my feed are VCs and founders arguing about the need of a financial model. And Jenny Fielding just posted 2 days ago, financial models are back. And, you know, saying like, investors are asking for them. They're back. Do you agree?
I totally agree. So fast forward 5 years ago. That's not that long ago. When everything, I mean, 5 years ago is not that long ago. And that was right around the time where we were just ideating on forecasts or things were just getting started. Back then, you really didn't need a financial model to get a fundraise done, especially whenever you're really early, kind of pre-seed, seed stage. You can get deals done all the time without a financial model. And it was relatively, I would say back then, rare that a financial model was a major point of early due diligence. Now, today, you know, we're sitting here in 2024. What we've seen is that a financial model is becoming significantly higher priority in due diligence for investors. And there's a couple of reasons for that. And there's a lot of theory behind that. I don't think that anybody's got like the golden answer for exactly why this is. My opinion on it is that, again, the opinion about financial modeling is slowly changing. And I think that that's because there are these new entrants into the market. So Forecaster is becoming more popular, but there are other companies like Pry, like Finmark, like Causal. There's becoming this suite of solutions that are becoming available for founders all around financial modeling. So that does two things. One, it takes your excuse away, right? Nobody can say, I can't build a financial model because there's just too many options now. You have too many outs to get a financial model built relatively cheaply. So there's just no excuse to not have one. So I think that that's one, and that might even be the bigger reason. But the second reason I think is because there's so much activity with new companies being created in FP&A, there's a lot more attention being focused on the financial model, and people are actually starting to look at it a little bit more closely, and they're realizing that there is value in a financial model. Like, is it going to be a perfect representation of exactly what's going to happen for a pre-seed company? Absolutely not. Of course not. That's just ridiculous to think. But does that mean that it has no value at all? Of course not. That's not what that means either. The answer is somewhere in the middle where there is value in it. It is a founder's best guess at that point in time of what they hope to achieve. And it is a numerical narrative of that best guess using finance and metrics. So I think investors are starting to warm up to this being something that is actually very valuable in due diligence. And like I said, there's just no excuse for not having one anymore. So I think both of those things together are causing this.
Well, it certainly resonates with me. I mean, it's interesting. At Alchemist, we don't require as an accelerator somebody to come in with a financial model. But one of the things that we do require in our interview process, our assessment process for the very, like, you know, sort of small slice of our applicants that get accepted is a very clear understanding of how founding teams are thinking about the problem space they're operating in and their opportunity. And so, to your point, I have definitely seen founders come in with models that are completely irrelevant to the actual future path of the business, but that doesn't matter. Because it shows us how they're thinking about the space. They're showing us the variables that they're considering. And it's an incredibly powerful tool for founders. So that really resonates.
Absolutely.
You talk about, hey, there's a lot of company formation going on right now. And there is. It's pretty wild, actually. I haven't seen anything like this in years. I want to use this as a segue into your company formation.
Yep.
We were talking, you know, just before the show a little bit about how you actually kind of got incubated in a little bit of a larger organization. Can you tell us a little bit about where Forecaster came from, what was unique about it, and what you learned?
No, absolutely. And I like telling this story because we do have a somewhat unique origin story. And I think that this story will resonate with a lot of people that maybe want to start a company, that maybe they're working for what would be a competing organization and they feel like they have no way of actually going out and starting it. So the backstory is I was working at a company that it wasn't a major company. It was a 30-person organization called Venture First. Mm-hmm. And it did a lot of different things, but for this purpose, it was essentially a fractional CFO firm. And it was a startup. Whenever I joined that company, I was employee number 6. By the time I left to start Forecaster full-time, it had grown to 30 employees. So the heart and soul of what we did there was build and manage financial models for founders, right? Probably sounds pretty familiar.
Sure.
But we used Excel to do all this because back then there were really no tools around that did this type of work for you. So me and my now co-founder, Steven, both worked there. That's where we learned everything that we now know about financial modeling. That's where we learned about all the pain points about financial modeling. We learned that most founders don't get it. We learned that most founders at least attempt it and people will pay money for it and so on and so forth. So Steven and I noticed all the problems in and around financial modeling, and we both simultaneously came up with the idea, but individually came up with the idea for Forecaster. We decided that there should be a web application that solved this problem, especially when you consider that every other business function that a startup has is supported by technology until you get to FP&A and the financial model, and then that's all done in Excel. So we were like, big opportunity. We should do something here. So this was the problem. This was back in 2018, whenever we decided that this was something that we wanted to do. Now, Steven and I both worked at Venture First, and we both had non-competes, and we were both doing a job that was technically competitive to the company that we wanted to create. We wanted to create a company that built financial models using software. Meanwhile, we were building financial models using Excel here at Venture First. So sure. What we did was whenever we decided that this was something that we wanted to do, our first step was we want to understand if this is a good idea. So we decided, let's just do a ton of customer discovery. Let's not act on anything. Let's just talk to founders. Let's talk to a lot of founders, like people that are outside of just the customers that we have right now. So we went on this big listening tour. We talked to hundreds of founders. We probably even more than we should have, you know, frankly, but we decided that for like 6 months, we wanted to do intense customer discovery. We talked to accelerators, talked to startup founders. We sent out surveys, and we were just trying to understand the universe of, hey, if we built this software, would people buy it? Is this a good idea, or are we wasting our time? So what this did was it gave us a lot of ammo and a lot of understanding about the problem and a lot of understanding about the opportunity. So by the time we were done with this process, we had a waitlist of hundreds of companies that wanted to use this, that hated Excel, that said that they would pay for this. And so we decided there's a massive opportunity here. We feel like we should go out and actually do something about this. So then we had to figure out how are we going to navigate that. Well, we took a gamble, and Steven and I set up a meeting with the CEO of Venture First, a guy named John Shumate, and we just laid all of our cards out on the table. And we told him about the idea that we had. Yep. We told him about all the customer discovery that we did. We showed him this list of hundreds of companies that said, we will buy this if you sell it. And we told him that this was a path that we wanted to go down. And we were very clear that we wanted to do this in our own company. We wanted to have the equity. Yep. We wanted to become the founders. We wanted to run with this.
And that's a brave conversation. We're going to come back to that.
Yeah, it was a break. And we were scared to have that conversation. Yeah. We were dreading it in a lot of ways, but we did have that conversation. and we didn't know what was going to happen. Frankly, I mean, John Shumate, the CEO, he could have said, good work, guys. This is all Venture First IP because you have your non-competes and you were doing that. And, you know, we weren't doing this during work hours, but still he could say, this is our idea. We're going to execute on this. We're going to go. But that's not how that conversation went down. John is a world-class CEO, and he decided that he wanted to lean into Steven and I. And we worked out a deal where not only was he going to allow us to start our own company, and he was going to be kind of an incubation type of deal, so they got equity in the company. So he was going to let us start it, but he also wrote us a check for $60,000 to help get the alpha built. So we hired a dev agency to go and get the alpha built. And he told us that he would fund our salaries until we were able to close a pre-seed round, at which point our salaries could be funded by the capital that we raised in that round of funding. So basically, Steven and I were able to become founding team members of this new company, Forecaster, with founder equity, and go out, raise a round while we still had day jobs, while our employer was completely aware of it, and then fund our own salaries once that round was done. So we never went a single day without a paycheck. And at the end of it, once we raised that first round of funding, we had founder equity in this new startup. We had full salaries and everything like that. So, you know, I think that the thing that's nuanced there is that there are people, I think, and I was even one of these people for a brief moment in time, that would have seen their situation as hopeless and said, look, I've got this idea. I really want to do something about this idea. But what can I do? I'm in this non-compete. I'm working for this competing company. There's nothing I can do about it. So I'm just going to let it die. But that's not true, right? If you just go and have those hard conversations with the people that are working at the company, you know, the leadership of the company that you're at, if you want to start something new, you might be surprised at what people will do when confronted with an opportunity like that, right? I mean, this was an opportunity to Venture First to have a good ownership in what could be and has become a very solid company. And that really excited John. It excited the leadership there. And fast forward, and I think we can all look back and say, that was a great deal for all parties involved. They got a great return on equity so far with their ownership of Forecaster. Steven and I obviously have a great return on our equity, and things have been going really, really well. So yeah, it's a little nuanced story there.
Thank you for sharing that story. I mean, I think that's actually really cool. And it's a rare story, right? And you kind of pointed out some of it, but like you just don't hear that often about these like self-driven venture creation stories within, you know, large organizations, right? And I know this wasn't a multinational, like 100,000 person enterprise, but it's a large organization. Yeah. And I think you raised the fear points. Obviously, some of this just kind of worked out really well for you. You said things like we never went without a salary and all that. Not everybody can expect that. But you did something really important here. When we're talking to large corporations about, you know, what is corporate innovation? One of the things that I talk about a lot is that innovation comes from a place of three things. It comes from a place of some kind of pain, right? Some kind of assessment of what's possible in the world to solve that pain. And then the really important one is action, right? You have to do something. And I would like to think that your story could be inspirational, not just for other potential founders, but for anybody sitting in a large organization who is thinking, I see something here. Can I take action? So I want to dig in a little bit more about that. You were probably rightfully nervous going into this conversation. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you can tell us? Like, how did you sort of prepare yourself for it? How did you prepare yourself to get the outcome that you wanted and also talk yourselves through maybe some of the tension you were feeling?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there's a couple of things that we did. So the first thing was we just ammoed ourselves with as much information as we possibly could. So Steven and I, we were preparers, right? I mean, we like to be very prepared for any conversation that we had. So if I was going to go to John Shumate, right, or the CEO, I wanted to make sure that I had a very compelling argument for why we should do this. Like John is a very smart person. He's been in venture for years and years and years. So I needed to have my facts ready to go. And the facts needed to be very compelling, which they were. So I was able to say, you know, 90% of people we interviewed would pay for this. this is the price point that we talked about. Here are the names of these people. And just like have a lot of weight behind that. And in a lot of ways, that transitioned really well for the fundraise too, because that same pitch for why we should do it, for why he should let us do it, that's the same pitch that I gave to investors that ended up writing a check and we were able to oversubscribe that round.
So it was fundamentally a fundraising pitch. It was.
It literally was, because he ended up writing us a check. So there was just the over preparation of just making sure that I had the most and we had the most compelling argument that we possibly could for why we should do this. So that was one. But then the second one was just, you know, having essentially contingency plans for what could have happened should that conversation have gone south, right? And Steven and I had to have this conversation of what are we prepared to do if Venture First is like, no, this is our thing, right? Like we're just going to take it. And we wouldn't have liked that outcome, but we were like, are we prepared to quit our jobs over this? Because like that would have been a rough start to the company, Ian. Like if they had said, no, we're not going to allow you to do this, what we would have had to have done was quit our jobs. We had non-competes, which I think expired, if maybe misremembering, but I think it was a 6-month non-compete. So what we would have had to have basically done was quit our jobs and not do anything for 6 months. We would have had to have gotten like a job at something totally unrelated to finance and startups or whatever, which is where our expertise was. And then post 6 months, then we could poke our heads up and actually take a crack at this. So we had kind of like a worst case scenario to fall back on if those conversations went badly. And it was significantly worse than the scenario that we ended up doing. But I think we both did find a little bit of comfort in that if this conversation completely flops, completely fails and gets really bad, we at least have another plan for how we could potentially make this thing work. So, and I think that really all that ended up doing for us, which is no small thing, was it just got us in the right mindset to have the conversation of if this fails, if this blows up, that doesn't mean that this company is just done. It doesn't mean that it's just dead, right? It's a way worse outcome for everybody, but that doesn't mean that it's just dead. So those are the big two things I would say.
You hit something else, like, and it doesn't mean that, you know, you're done as Logan, that your co-founder is done, right? Like you went to the worst case place and you're like, all right, I don't know that I'd like this, but I'm probably not going to be starving, right? Yeah. I can get another job. Yeah. I can go work, you know, sell used cars, whatever it is. So I think that's a really, like, I'm just kind of going to put an emphasis point on that. Like part of your preparation for taking action was thinking through like, what's the worst case scenario? And you got yourselves comfortable that, like it might suck, but it's not that bad.
It's not that bad. And it's actually core in the DNA of what Forecaster is all about even today, because a big part of financial modeling is just preparing yourself for the worst and hoping for the best, which is like, there's two paths here, right? Either they're going to be cool with it and everything's going to work out in the way that it has worked out, which has been great, or they're not going to be cool with it. And if that is true, that sucks, but here's what we're going to do about that. And this is exactly what it is. And it's one of those things that, you know, I've heard this before, just general life advice is that if you can get yourself comfortable with the absolute worst case scenario in any situation, anything at all, and you can think through, well, if I lose my job, then that would suck, but like this is what I would do, and I could ride it out for this amount of time, and oh, I could go move in with this person. You know what I mean? Like you start to think through what is actually like the worst thing that could happen. And I think for most people, it's really not as bad as you think. I think a lot of people get a lot of anxiety over that uncertainty of, oh, if this happens, I don't even know what I'll do, you know? But if you actually force yourself to like write down and go through that thought exercise of this is actually what I would do, you kind of look at it and you're like, it's not that bad. You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's just kind of funny.
Well, and look, like, what is innovation, right? Innovation is change. Somebody's changing behavior, right? If innovation is going to be successful.
Yep.
It is risk. And one of the friction points that blocks innovation constantly is risk aversion, right? Mm-hmm. It happens at a cultural level, at a national level, at a corporate level, at an individual level. And so I love that framework for as individuals and as a team, because you did this with your co-founder, working through what is my assessment of risk. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I work around the world and there's a lot of, I'll kind of operate at the national level. There's a lot of countries that really struggle with innovation because that risk equation has more consequence, right? because the what is the worst case might look like, oh, I get kicked out of the country that I've made my home, or, you know, something else. Right. And it's really unfortunate. It makes me feel really privileged to be in a place like the US, like wildly imperfect country in many, many ways. But I do love that balance of, you know, there's enough kind of pain and grit and friction to make people want to drive for change. Mm-hmm. But also, if you really do that worst case analysis, you're probably going to be okay.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think you touched on it right, which is that is a stopping point for a lot of innovation, which is why I feel so strongly about doing that exercise. I mean, again, if you go through the thought experiment of worst case scenario, I lose my job, I can't pay rent, I move in with parents or sibling or whatever, and like I will struggle for X amount of time and then I'm certain I will be fine. I think a lot of people, once they do that, they might be like, is it worth it? Is it worth it to potentially change my life and potentially the life of my descendants, right? I mean, I could create generational wealth if I am able to pull off what I want to pull off. Is it worth that risk for this now defined downside, yeah, right? And I think that especially for people that are a little bit younger too, if like, because I started Forecaster when I was in my 20s, I mean, the mindset that I was in was, if this face plants and I just completely blow this up and I go 2 years without a job in my 20s, that's going to be totally fine in the grand scheme of my life. And it is so worth it to just give it a shot, you know, just go for it and give it a shot. And if it fails, it fails. And, you know, I think that that's a really important exercise to anybody that wants to make the leap and do something like that. Because I think that if you create that T chart of pros and cons, and you really try to define them both as to the infinite level of detail that you can, I think the choice kind of becomes obvious in a lot of ways. Like, just go for it. And I'll say this too, Ian, I work with Forecasters, work with over 1500 entrepreneurs. I've built my entire career over working with startup founders, even people that have failed their companies in the most gnarly way possible. I've never once ever met a founder that's like, I regret giving it a shot, I regret betting on myself. Like, it doesn't matter. You at least tried, you know, which is more than a lot of people can say.
Yeah. I love that. That's incredibly inspirational. But I'm going to pivot our conversation. You're building this company in a world that is changing, and it's changing rapidly, right? The pace of change in technology is kind of insane. I think nobody actually really understands what it is right now, between the, you know, techno-optimists that are like, we're going to have AGI next year and, you know, maybe we're going to pause for a while. But the pace of change in technology is rapid.
Yep.
Often caused by technology, there's a lot of societal change happening at every level, how people communicate, globalization, you name it. This is causing problems for a lot of established organizations, governments, enterprises, you name it. They are really struggling to stay current and stay connected. So, you know, we were talking earlier and you mentioned you're seeing a lot more focus on startups. Do you think is that an attempt by corporations to stay connected, stay current? Is something else going on?
I think absolutely. I mean, I think that that's 100% what it is. I mean, if you think about too, just how larger organizations can stay current, you only have a few options, and really it kind of boils down into two. You could either take your shot at every new and innovative thing that could happen that's within the sphere of where you are and just try to participate in all of it, or you could partner with a bunch of different startups, see what rises to the top, see which things, the zeitgeist out there, you know, like what is actually resonating with a large group of people, and then just acquire that company and then put it under your umbrella, right? So, but if you have to weigh those two options of like, well, do I just want to participate and build everything using my own resources, or do I want to take a lot of small bets, see which ones rise to the top and then snatch those? Like, that is such a better path. And I think with all of the new things that are happening right now with AI and all of this like explosion of technology, I think you're starting to see, especially in our sector, which is the finance sector, which is a little bit more of a laggard sector, I would argue.
Sure.
A lot of these companies are starting to get significantly more involved in partnering with startups. And I think that that's why. I think that they just need to understand where is the consumer going? What is actually resonating with the consumer without using an outsized amount of their own resources? And then, and you're seeing, you know, M&A, like, by the companies that are actually resonating with a large group of people. And that is how these companies stay relevant, right?
It's the only way. I think it's the only way. You mentioned, you know, you have this choice. Do we try and build it ourselves? Like, in my mind, that way lies madness. I don't know if you know John Gruber. He follows that Apple ecosystem and Mac, but I was listening to a podcast with him and Ben Thompson the other day, and he said every once in a while, he says something really smart, and this one really stuck out at me, and I've got the quote up here. It's, no matter how big and successful any company gets, history has always shown that an internal culture of not invented here is, for everything across the board, the path to ruin, the path to painting yourself into a corner.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I will say, in my experience, you know, this problem of it's not invented here, therefore I don't want to do it. And the flip side of that is we're just going to try and build everything we need ourselves. Yep. It's pretty pervasive in the world. You know, so I got two questions for you.
Yep.
One, do you see that changing? And two, how does that impact Forecaster? Because as companies get bigger, or maybe you start intersecting with more established companies, I have to imagine you do come up against the, well, we can build something.
Yeah, you do kind of. I would say come across that. I mean, I think that I generally really resonate with that quote. I will say one of the things that I've always found to be true, and just kind of working with a bunch of startups, obviously, because that's who we work with, but partnering with larger companies, and Forecaster has a lot of different partnerships with a lot of, you know, major companies. It's just that the passion that comes with a small group of people that are basing their lives around solving a really hard problem is just, in my experience, unmatched by what you find in corporate environments. And I think that, I mean, for all the benefits that larger corporations have with the war chest that they have at their disposal and all of that, they have a lot of weaknesses too. And this is why starting companies and startups are so important. A startup, if Forecaster wanted to completely pivot our strategy, we could do that in a week, right? Yep. That is how quick we can act, right? That is how quickly we can read the market, because we're a team of 36 people and we talk all the time. We're super close. Now, if I'm a large company, if I got thousands of employees, tens of thousands of employees, I can't move with the market like that. I just can't. I don't have the ability to do that. And so that's why, I mean, people ask, like, how are you as a startup going to compete with, you know, maybe Microsoft, because that's Excel, right? I mean, they've been around forever.
I hate that question, go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, and it's a lazy investor question, you know, if I'm being harsh about it, but like the answer is, it's really two things. It's, we can pivot 100 times faster than they can, which is very underrated. That is like an incredibly important thing. And B, like, where our technology may lack compared to theirs, our humans and our ability to solve a problem by whatever means necessary will outpace theirs, because our customer has our full and undivided attention.
Yep.
Full and undivided, versus this bigger corporation where this is a footnote of a footnote.
And that, I think, is actually both, from my perspective, that's the most important answer to this lazy investor question, or frankly, the question that you might get from your uncle, your mother, that it's like, ooh, why are you taking this risk, right? But like, you know, but it's also part of this conversation about the importance of rethinking innovation inside corporations, right? Like, it's not just that you can pivot more quickly. It's not just that you're more passionate. And it's not actually just that it's the thing that you do. Because of all of those things, you have more resource, you have more money, you have more time, you have more passion focused on this problem than the large company's ever going to have. You are going to win to an extent, until and unless you need the distribution and scale. And in a changing world, in that world, it feels to me like these large companies really need to be paying attention. It feels like the Microsofts of the world should be a strong partner with Forecaster, because ultimately you benefit them in some way.
100%. And you see it in practice. I mean, like in our case, Microsoft quite literally is a massive partner of Forecaster. You know what I mean? And that's just one of our partners. And it all comes back to that tried and true playbook that has been run by corporations, at least at some extent, for the past several years, which is, I mean, at varying degrees of activity, you see it all the time. Corporations partner with startups and they get involved and they see what's resonating and what's not. And then they acquire the ones that seem to be working out really well. There's a reason that this has been happening for a long period of time. It's because that's just a better way to grow as a large organization. I mean, if you think about it, companies like Google, companies like Microsoft, I mean, billions, if not trillions of dollars at their disposal, right? So they've got so much money, so much like of a war chest that is built up, that a portion of that is literally for this, is to look at what is something interesting that we could acquire to strengthen our own brand, right?
100%.
And so if you do that and you weigh that against just like hiring a bunch of people, building departments, confusing your internal organization for, oh, now we're focusing on this, but no, now we're focusing on that. And how does this all add up? Like, it's just kind of a mess. And it just makes so much more sense just to be a nimble startup, partner with them. And in a lot of ways, you know, I'd like to turn that question on its head with like, how are you going to compete with, you know, XYZ big corporation? It's like, how are they going to compete with us, right? This is our world. This is our entire life.
By the way, that's a founder mentality. I love that. Say that again. How are they going to compete with us? I love that.
Yeah, right, right. I mean, that's the mentality you have to have. So, but it's a great question.
No, that's really good. And just to kind of wrap this up. So I spent over a decade at Microsoft, and Microsoft's full of very, very smart people. Almost every single time that in hindsight, I saw or I or we made a horrible mistake, it was because we didn't actually understand what we should be building versus what we should be partnering on.
Yep.
And that is a trap we all fall into. Yep. Well, so Logan, we're coming to kind of the close of our hour here. And I want to make sure that we get some kind of quick hit advice, because you've been on a journey that some of our listeners want to be on, right? The journey of transitioning into a founder, building a company, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So like, can we just talk about some of the other lessons that you've learned as you have raised capital, built your company? What advice do you give to aspirational founders, whether or not they are currently employed by a larger company?
Yep. So one of them we've already touched on, which is just take the leap. The worst case scenario is going to be probably a lot better than you think it is. So if you feel like starting a company, starting a new initiative is something that you're at least a little bit interested in, I just implore you, give it a shot. You're not going to regret it. I've never met anybody that has. And when you're 80 years old, you know, you're not going to look back and be like, man, that was such a bad mistake. So that's my first one, but that's kind of like general advice, but more tactical advice, I would say, something that's like a little bit more nuanced. It's just something that I've seen founders struggle with all the time is just, if they're going to fundraise, they start the process too late. And especially for companies that maybe they've raised a little bit of money and they need to go raise more money. And so they've got these expenses, they've hired these people. And a lot of times founders will wait until maybe 2 or 3 months before their fume date, you know, before they run out of money. And they're like, all right, now we're going to go fundraise. And this is like a big point of company failure. It's too late. Yeah. So that, I just wanted to make sure I got that very, very tactical piece of feedback out there is, you want to, you know, 6 to 8 months before you hit that fume date, that's whenever you want to actually be beating the streets and fundraising. Yeah. So that's a more tactical piece.
You might actually want to have a financial plan, perhaps.
Absolutely. And that's the other piece. And it's funny, my co-founder, Steven, he was a founder before Forecaster. He had started a company before called Fantasy Hub. And he always said they never had more than 3 months of runway the entire time that they ran the company. And that company ended up failing for a variety of reasons. The 3 months of runway certainly didn't help their outcome at all. But he was telling me they never really were able to make any kind of like big strategic grounded conversation or like decisions, because they're always just trying to stay above water. They're like, how are we going to make payroll? Who is the investor that's going to fund? You know what I mean? Like, you can't actually sit down and think about the future of the business. So it's both tactical advice, you know, to make sure that you are well capitalized and you start your fundraise early, but it weirdly becomes strategic advice, because when you're well funded and you have 18 months of runway, you can actually think. You can sit down and really actually think about, okay, fundraising aside, what are we actually going to do here?
Yeah, I actually think that is really important. And building on that, I mean, you know, the reason you can't think fundraising is all consuming. And so that's a piece of advice that I also make sure to give. Like, yes, you need to fundraise early, but you need to recognize when you're fundraising, it's all you're doing. Yeah. And if you're always fundraising and you're trying to do it off the side of your desk, like, that's awful. And I've been in that position. Like, we have investors. Like, I have been in the position of fundraising and realizing it was going too long. And it sucks because you can't focus on the future. So that's great advice. Thank you for that, Logan.
Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah.
So, and go ahead.
I was going to say one more bit of nuance there is that that's whenever it's very helpful to have a co-founder, because you hit the nail on the head. Fundraising is a full-time job. At the very minimum, it's going to take 80 to 90% of your attention. So if you have one co-founder that whenever it's time to fundraise, they're fundraising and that is what they're doing, then you can have another co-founder that's like, while you're fundraising, I'm going to be running the business and making sure that we hit our goals. Because I see this all the time too. Single founder goes out, fundraises, because they're fundraising, their metrics suffer, which makes the fundraise harder. And it's like a vicious downward spiral type of deal.
Awful.
So, yeah. So it's always good to have a good co-founder whenever you're raising.
Really good thought. Well, what's next for Forecaster? You guys have had some success. It's really great to see. Tell me about the next few months, few years, few decades.
Absolutely. So our ultimate vision is to become the default operating system for FP&A for the venture-backed ecosystem. So that is our North Star. That's what we're all challenged. That is the path that we're marching down. So everything is building towards that vision for us. And I think, to give you a really tactical answer, for us, we've got good success. We have a good customer base. We've got good revenue. We've got a great team. A lot of it's going to be product focused because it's kind of a wide open field, even still, in terms of competition. There's just not a lot of people just dominating the market. Of course, we have competitors, but nobody's absolutely crushing. So what we want to do is we want to own that connective tissue of the ecosystem between the founder and the investor. We think if we can crack that nut and be at the intersection point of the founder-investor conversation, not just for fundraising, but even post-fundraise, that's where you're going to see a lot of virality and a lot of growth. So future for us is going to be a lot of portfolio analytics. It's going to be a lot of giving investors, advisors, insight into all the companies that they're working with, which ones are doing really well, which ones are struggling, which ones are coming up on their runway, their fume date, all of that stuff. That connective tissue, we believe, is going to be absolutely massive for the future growth of the company. So that's really what we're focusing on right now. And that's what we're going to be focusing on for the next several years. And we believe that if we can pull that off, you're going to see that virality really take off. And it's going to increase our revenue. It's going to increase our engagement, our usage, all of that stuff. So that's the future, I would say, generally for us.
Well, I love it. Y'all have come a long way from, you know, pitching your CEO in trepidation, going through fundraising, going through an accelerator program with Techstars, I believe.
Yep.
Really, really excited for what's next for you. For folks that want to follow you or stay in touch, where should they look? LinkedIn, Twitter, the website?
Yep. LinkedIn is great. Logan Burchett, just search me on LinkedIn and add me and I'll accept you. Another one is we're doing a lot of founder-led content now. So check me out on YouTube too. I'm trying to put a lot of videos together around finance, fundraising, founder life, all of that stuff. And if you want to check out Forecaster, just go to forecaster.co. So forecaster.co. And if Forecaster, by the way, is spelled without an E at the end. So it's just forecast and then r.co. So check us out.
Awesome. Well, we'll get all those linked in the show notes. Logan, thanks so much. This was super fun. Really appreciate having you on the podcast.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Ian. It's always great to have a conversation like this. And I love talking about this type of stuff. So I really appreciate you having me.
Awesome. Cheers. Enjoy the rest of your day.
All right. Thanks. You too, Ian.
So that's a wrap for today's episode of Alchemist X Innovators Inside. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you found value and insight in today's discussion, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast and never miss an episode. Don't forget to share with your friends, colleagues, or anyone who is passionate about corporate innovation or just curious about great ideas and practical insights. Until next time, I'm Ian Bergman. Thanks for tuning in.